It is my great pleasure to welcome Nicholas Egan back to Many Rivers Books and Tea, but he doesn't make it easy for me to introduce him because he's such an accomplished guy at such a young age that it's just hard to know where to start and where to end.
I'm really not that young nor accomplished.
With Dr. Egan and his rectorship and having founded the Advaya Institute, his teaching capacity in his Tibetan lineage, his knowledge of sacred art, his knowledge of education in the realm of, I think he is assistant head?
Associate head of school.
Associate head of school at the Healdsburg School. So one hardly knows where to go from there, so I will let him go into the body and spiritual practice. Please welcome Nick Egan.
Thank you. It's the worst part about doing talks at Many Rivers, the introductions. Always so hard to live up to. So, rather than diving directly into a talk, let's do a few minutes of sitting practice. Is that okay? Okay. Very simple. You can sit up, and unless you have a specific tradition that tells you to open your eyes, please do close your eyes. And just relax your shoulders a little bit. Pay attention to your breathing, but don't breathe in a specific way. Attention to your thoughts. See if you can catch with your awareness the space between one thought arising and then drifting away. Allow your mind to melt or dissolve into a kind of spaciousness. It's very simple, just deeply let go. Try to keep some of that spacious feeling as you slowly rock to the left and the right, and then gently open your eyes. So, we're here to talk about the body and spiritual practice. There are a few different perspectives or lenses that my tradition, the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and just Buddhism in general takes toward the body. But I always like to speak somewhat broadly so that it's applicable to any tradition. So if you are curious about parallels, and maybe I can come up with some off the top of my head, feel free to ask questions about that as well. The first is also probably the least applicable to us, as far as I can tell. Maybe not all of us, but some of us. And that is the lens or the perspective of the renunciate. And renunciate means somebody that has given up certain aspects of what you'd consider worldly life, you know, non-spiritual life, and devoted their energy and effort toward attaining some sort of spiritual goal, in Buddhism, enlightenment, of course. So a renunciate could be, in the West, we typically call them monks or nuns, but actually there are, you know, many grades below, not below, I should say, novice monks, and then people that aren't full monks, but sort of live a monastic lifestyle. Same thing for nuns as well. But what I mean when I say renunciate is sort of that perspective, going to a place, usually a monastery or a nunnery, meditating with a specific goal in mind. That's a pretty idealized opinion of what actually goes on in monasteries, but we'll just bracket that for now. So the renunciate's view on the body is something that presents itself as an obstacle to spiritual practice. Why? Because the body can be seen as the foundation of a kind of desire, especially toward other people's bodies. So I'm talking here specifically about sexual desire, but it can be any kind of desire. And so toward that end, a lot of the monastic meditations that would be considered body-centered are actually geared toward alleviating desire toward other bodies. So if you're a monk or a nun, there are specific meditations. If you happen to see that pretty young thing walking by and have some moment of arousal, then you either in the moment or later on can do a meditation that really focuses on the not so pretty parts. For instance, their bones or their blood or, you know, the guts and excrement, all the nasty stuff, sort of as a salve to the heated desire that you're feeling. Now again, don't judge it too harshly. It has a point. The point is to give distance to the person that has chosen a path that precludes the use of desire within a spiritual path. And that's not every path, but it's that path for sure. So for most of us, that's not typically the path that we're choosing. There are some exceptions, maybe even in the room. But I mention that because if you delve deeply enough into the literature, you're bound to find these things that are very much anti-body from the perspective of Buddhist teachings. Everybody okay with that so far? Okay. I told that there was a... I have a friend who's a monk. Actually, no, it was a monk. Was a monk, I should say. And they once said that even their bones were desirable when they were doing this meditation practice. So it doesn't always work, you know. The mind finds a way to have desire flourish. So the second way, or the second lens that we can talk about tonight, is I think more applicable to us as Westerners, somewhat modern, and perhaps interested in spirituality, and that is the way of the householder. Now, householder in Buddhist terminology means not necessarily somebody that owns a house, but somebody who has the capability of owning personal property, real property, you know, real estate, and also typically can be married or at least have a romantic relationship. Marriage is actually a little bit fluid in Himalayan Buddhism. But that aside, you get the gist, sort of normal everyday life. Now, we often think in the West, this idealized version of the monk, that to be a real spiritual practitioner, you have to go become a monk. And it's actually not the case at all. At least within my tradition, very strongly, many of the highest level teachers are not monks. They may wear robes and people think that they're monks, but they don't hold monastic vows. So sometimes they'll have wives or whatever. Now, being a householder myself, I tend to be drawn to that because I think that it's not necessarily the external trappings of spirituality, it's more about the internal experience of spirituality. So a householder's perspective from a general viewpoint is one in which the body supports spiritual practice. Now, what that looks like is they will do specific meditations or aspirations to keep the body healthy and then they will practice certain healthful routines in order to allow the body to last as long as possible, to be of most benefit to all sentient beings, and to further themselves in the spiritual path, which are two ways of saying the same thing, right? Spiritual path is not separate from helping people. If you think otherwise, maybe problem. So, if one were to practice this, it would be, you're out jogging or you're eating healthfully with a very specific intention, not to look better in a bikini or whatever, but to actually create a kind of longevity and a wellness that supports spiritual practice. And so, from that perspective, healing and health and taking care of the body is very much a sign of a healthy spiritual perspective. Now, if we go a little bit deeper into that tradition, or in some ways it's a third perspective, and I didn't think about this talk before I came, otherwise I would have come up with a better idea, but I'll just call it the tantric perspective. So a tantric perspective. Tantra is a way of thinking about spirituality that, tantra literally means continuum. Have you all heard of tantra? Yes? Yeah? Sexual practices and all this stuff? Okay. Those are misunderstandings of something that is within tantric tradition in Tibet and in India in general, but it's a total bastardization of the actual practice. Tantra actually means continuum, and the continuum is actually our spirit or our mind. And what people from a tantric perspective do with their body is they actually connect with the energy that's within their body as a way to create mental states that are conducive to meditation. Yoga is one example of this. Yoga, actually, so I'm talking about physical hatha yoga, the yoga that everybody's doing, comes from tantric Hindu, mostly, perspective. It's just, it became kind of divorced from that early tradition. So working with the body, the idea here is I'm doing a yoga pose, and through breathing and through my posture, I'm able to influence the way that my energy flows in the body. If I can influence the way that my energy flows in the body, I influence the way my mind experiences the world. Right? Mm-hmm. Okay? So the energy is the bridge between body and mind. Same thing goes for if you're meditating. If you can go the opposite way and do meditations in which your body can be affected. In fact, one of the signs of an advanced form of meditation called shamatha is a strong pliability in your body. So you can sit in full lotus for, days, literally. And that's one of the signs that you know. Why? Because your mind has released its tightness, its hold on the body. Now, that energy, so mind, energy, body, and then body, energy, mind, goes both ways. Is everybody with me so far? So I can, if you concentrate, for instance, on a chakra, energy center in the body, you can then elicit a response that is actually physical. So you can generate energy in that specific place, whatever chakra you're working with. From that, then, it influences the body. So there's you can go mental, energy, physical, and go the other way, too. It's a lot of highfalutin business. Anybody want to, any questions about that so far? Really?
Just the name, again, of the one, the sitting meditation, sitting practice that helps.
Shamatha?
Oh, okay.
Shamatha just means, Tibetan is shine, it means calm abiding, resting. It just means when you're settling your mind on something, it's a whole category of meditation. So probably most meditation that you've ever done is a form of shamatha. So if you're sitting, counting your breathing, your object of awareness is the counting, or sometimes it could be the physical manifestation of your breathing. When you rest your mind on that, and then the mind goes, and then you rest your mind on it again, that stable resting is what's called shamatha.
Is that what you were referring to when you were saying that releases that puts the flexibility that was into your body?
If you stabilize your mind through any mental object, okay, your body will naturally become more flexible, and it's a sign of success in that practice. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So,
The reverse is true, too.
It reverses what?
This is true as well.
Yeah, the reverse is true as well. If you do yogic practice, and in Tibet they're very, very strong. Actually, some of the oldest extant texts that we have on physical yoga come out of Tibet via India. And if you do your yogic practice and do your breathing, you naturally will have a more calm mind. You may need to kind of shift over into the mental. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you know if you do so? Have you ever had periods in your life where you're doing some sort of yoga or Tai Chi or physical practice and it helps your mind stabilize? Yes, some people? Okay. I will say this as a slight caveat before we move into any kind of practice. It is possible to have a kind of spiritual practice that is solely physical, that doesn't necessarily involve the mind as much as it could. I'm thinking of people that practice certain forms of yoga, for instance, that are not being conscious and not practicing with a kind of intention, mm-hmm. and are relying solely on the physical. And in that situation, that's fine, nothing wrong with that. But from a Buddhist perspective, specifically a Tibetan perspective, you're missing out on something. And what you're missing out on is the possibility that when you have no more body to meditate on, you now have no practice. Right? A little bit of a problem. You're going through and you're practicing your yoga, death, and then you want to keep practicing, but no more body to practice. And really, honestly, if you can't, there's really only one point to practicing any kind of spirituality, but specifically in Buddhism, to attain enlightenment, whatever that might mean. And if you can't continue your practice past the point of death, then it just becomes maybe a practice for this life. And that's okay, but it's not maybe the best. So we want to make sure that we're always involved in the mind. So, because we're talking about the body, we should sit up a little bit. Within the body there are, really, I think according to almost every Dharmic tradition that I know of, there's this idea that energy is running through the body, specifically certain channels within the body. And if you're familiar with acupuncture, I'm talking about the thrusting vessels. In Tibetan Buddhism, they call it the central channel. And it's a channel that runs up the very center of your body, not on the outside, but in the very center, in the middle, from the coccyx down up to the top of your head. And the idea there is if it's that channel is unobstructed, it's much more easy for the energy to flow in that channel. What's the benefit? The benefit is you can have this insight of wisdom or non-duality or the truth of things or enlightenment or the nature of mind, however you want to describe it. But it's more difficult to do if you don't have that energy flowing through the central channel. So just sitting up creates the conditions that are conducive to that experience. Great story about a monk. I don't know where this story came from. I hate to tell stories where I can't cite the sources, so I'm sure this is just an apocryphal made-up story. But it's good. There's a monk sitting in the jungle, and there was a monkey that would bother him, like poking at him, and the monk didn't move, just sitting in his posture. And so finally the monkey sits down in front of the monk and tries the meditation posture, and day in, day out. And sooner or later, the monkey attains enlightenment before the monk. I don't know where. I'm sure some clever teacher made that up. So, just sitting up straight. In Zen, they talk about this, the dignity of your posture. Right? Very, very nice to sit down and just have a kind of relaxed, straight posture. So what we're trying to do is create a kind of awareness that is not too tight, but not too relaxed. So we're just doing that same thing with our body. We're upright. Our head is being pulled up toward the ceiling, and our shoulders are totally relaxed, and our jaw especially is relaxed. My jaw can't be too relaxed. I'm too busy flapping it. Yeah, good. So, from there, breathing is very important. In Tibetan, the word for breathing, the word for this energy is the same, lung. In Sanskrit, it's prana, or vayu. In Chinese, it's qi. In Latin, interestingly, it's spiritus, right? So I'm respiration and inspiration and spirit all come from the same root. Fascinating. A lot of cross-cultural smoke. sometimes there's fire. So, if we sit and we pay attention to our breathing, the most optimum breathing is that which is centered around the belly. Now, we don't actually obviously breathe into our belly, but it is diaphragmatic breathing. It's this diaphragm that goes across right there. So ideally, your chest is not moving at all. However, your belly is moving in and out here. I'll exaggerate just a little bit. People, if they're trying this for the first few times, feels uncomfortable because they focus on breathing in. The secret is focus on breathing out and pushing your belly in. And then when you breathe in, it naturally goes out a little bit. We're all amazing diaphragmatic breathers. It's lovely. So, that's crucial point number two for meditating with the body. Now, there's a lot of confusion about visualization and imagining and things like that. So I'm going to use a different way of talking about visualization. I want you to try to feel the area, not the anatomy, but put your mind in the area that I'm describing. In the same way, first let's try an experiment. Keeping your posture. Try to feel the bottom of your feet with your mind. Don't move them, don't push them against anything, just feel them. Now try to feel the tops of your knees. Okay, that's what I mean by putting your mind in a thing. And it's totally different than I'm going to imagine my feet, right? I can imagine my feet very well, but it may not be feeling my actual feet at the time. So now we're going to try to feel that spot that's about 2 or 3 inches below our navel in the very center of our body. So go ahead and close your eyes and try to feel that spot. Your eyes closed, and I want you to hold your breath a little bit the next time you breathe in, just a little bit, and then breathe out, and make sure you push the air out fluidly, and then breathe in and just hold the breath a little bit. Keep your mind on that spot, below and behind your navel, in the very center of your body. I want you to feel as if there's a small orb of energy or light in that spot. Don't see it, feel it. It has a kind of warmth to it. A feeling of being very cozy. Keep your mind on that spot, and as you breathe out, imagine that ball of warmth or ball of energy starts to radiate out that positive feeling of physical warmth. Your mind stays in the spot, but the rays spread throughout your body, spreading with it a kind of cozy, positive, joyful feeling. Your mind on that spot and focus on breathing out and letting that warmth radiate through your whole body, feeling in every spot. Sometimes it helps to smile a little bit to yourself. You to let go of the breathing pattern and let go of any visualization. Just focus on that warm, positive feeling. And let your mind just dissolve into that. Give yourself permission to just let go into that for a few moments. Gently rock to the right and the left. And slowly open your eyes. So that exercise is called, I guess you would translate it as gentle vase breathing. Gentle vase breathing. The idea is that you are the vase. Your lower abdomen is the vase, and it's gentle. You don't hold too forcefully. And obviously breathing is involved. And the point of that is to bring your energy to the very center of your body, in that second chakra, if you know yogic terminology. Tibetans call it the wheel of joy, interestingly. And when you do that, to then generate a little bit of warmth, a little bit of gentle warmth, and spread that through your body as a way of calming your mind down, calming your entire energy system down. Now, we've talked about how the body influences the mind via energy. When you're working directly with energy, there's one of the ways with which we can calm our mind is actually through energy. So I mentioned the physical ramifications. If you accomplish a kind of stability meditation, then you have this increased physical flexibility. But also your energy system becomes much more pliable, pliant, workable. So a way to access the mind that I think is sometimes more efficient for what some of my students find it much more helpful than just sitting down and doing a purely mental practice, because it accesses the mind via the back door of sort of the energy. And in Buddhism, they talk about this, the mind is like the rider of a horse that's lame, that doesn't have use of their legs. So they rely on the horse, but the horse is sort of blind, so it has to have the rider. So you can't really separate out the two. So mind goes with energy. Which brings up all kinds of fascinating implications for death. Like, what happens with death to all this energy? But another topic. Questions about the practice that we just did. Comments about the practice that we just did. Jim.
You know Zen Master Hakuin?
Hakuin? Yeah.
Hakuin?
Yes.
The description of this meditation reminded me that the story is that he was doing koan practice. Koan practice, for those who might not know, is a form of introspection where you dwell on certain unsolvable questions. And he got quite ill. And he was sent into the mountains to learn a kind of meditation where he drew the energy down into his belly.
Yeah.
And to make a long story short, I mean, it's very well written. Physically regained his energy, but not only that, the answers to the koans came very, very quickly.
Right.
And the mountain hermit said that what he had done is, this is Taoist terminology, that he was bringing the fire element to his brain.
Right.
And he needed to bring the fire element into his belly. And I know your description reminded me of that story, and I'm wondering if I'm on target there.
Very similar. Very, very similar. So interesting story about Hakuin. One of my most favorite Zen authors, if you ever get a chance to read him. When was he? What century do you know? Like 16th century? Yeah. Okay, so 15th century in Japan. He was doing this koan practice, so, you know, the sound of one hand clapping. That was his koan,
yes.
I believe.
Yes,
he created that koan. And he's doing these phrases, these unanswerable phrases, in order you kind of short-circuit your ordinary conceptual thinking. And when you short-circuit your ordinary conceptual thinking, that's a very sort of fierce way to do it. You can have this glimpse into oneness, into the ultimate reality, or Buddha nature, or whatever you want to call it. And so he went up to this Taoist hermit. Very interesting. But do you remember what the Taoist hermit first said to him? The Taoist hermit, so he was doing this sect of Zen that focuses on koan practice. And the Taoist hermit said, well, your practice is reliant on thinking. The natural thing to do is to do the no-thinking practice, which is this other sect of Zen is very much known for just sitting, the Shikantaza thing. And Hakuin said, I don't want to practice that sect of Zen. Can't you give me some like Taoist special stuff? And then he gave him the energy practice of melting the energy down and bringing the fire down and sort of reversing. If anybody's practiced Taoist yoga, very similar to the beginning stages of, well, what we just did, actually. So it's the idea that you bring the warmth of the chi down, and then you use it to sort of ignite this cauldron, and then the metaphorical cauldron within your belly, and then the steam, the vapor, literally the chi, raises up and nourishes your brain. Very, I like, Taoist yoga has a lot of parallels to Tibetan energy practice. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I love Hakuin. He's my most favorite.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's really good. He's always calling people eaters of fox vomit. He's like, these fox vomit eaters, he's like scolding these other Zen masters. It's the best. You have to be enlightened to talk about fox vomit. It's the rule. You had a question.
When you first kind of were guiding us, visualize or imagine the center point.
Feel.
Okay, feel. But it's still a mental activity. Are there any physical things that's ever suggested to do, like movement, or to really get the hara belly felt sense?
There is.
Then just won't, you know.
Yeah, so first of all, the breath, holding the breath and lightly tightening is considered the physical. That's the soft version of physical. But there is one further step. So what you do is, and you don't have to do this, it's only if you're having a hard time getting to that center, like what you're talking about, getting the felt sense. And what you can do is, in fact, let's all try it. Sit up. You don't have to close your eyes. You have to watch me. So try to put your mind in that spot. Try to feel that spot. Give yourself a second. Feel it in the middle. And then start doing the breathing. Belly breathing, and then hold it a little bit, and then pull up on your pelvic floor just a little bit, like you're doing a Kegel exercise, and then release, and now do it again, and just watch me on this one. You kind of do that belly dancer move, and then breathe out. You can try it if you want. Everybody, let's
try to create a container.
Yeah, you're containing exactly. Container from the top and the bottom, and then moving it around. Let's try it right now. So breathe in, hold, push down, pull up, and then just 1, 2, 3, and then 1, 2, 3, and then breathe out. Let's do it 2 more times. Breathe in, close your eyes, hold, pull up on your pelvic floor, rock around in a circle 3 times, and then 3 times the other way. Keep your mind on that spot. Breathe out. That makes me warm. Breathe in again. Hold. Pull up on your pelvic floor. Circle 3 times. And then 3 times the other way. And then breathe out. actually, if you just do that practice every day for a few weeks, you'll notice some calming of the mind. Other questions? It's getting hot. You can start off one by one.
Well, my question is kind of simple. All the energy that is stimulated in the pelvic area and in the intestinal area is drawn up. What about drawing it down and out to release there? Why is it always going up?
It's not always going up. It goes out in ordinary activities as well. So actually in sexual arousal, that's an example of energy really flowing down and then being contained, and then in orgasm, it's all coming directly from the teachings. It flows out. It certainly does. So what you're trying to do in this practice is you're generating energy, but you don't really want it to go out anywhere. You want it to kind of harness right here, and then it radiates out the warmth. But the locus of the energy is here. It's just the calming rays or the cozy rays sort of go out and fill the whole body, but that you're containing the energy there as a way of containing your mind. In some later forms of meditation, you do have it go up and through the central channel. And the point of that is, according to the teachings, energy moving up through the central channel is very conducive to, at the time of death, having a death experience that perhaps can open the door to a kind of oneness with everything and enlightenment in a stabilized form. The teachings say that everybody has an experience of a clear light experience at the time of death, but there are some people that through practice are able to maintain it in a stabilized way, and that's synonymous with enlightenment. So it is focused on going up. She turned to him and said, "I have so many questions." So she gets two.
But that could also be argued for the downward movement, the Timor. You know, that there is this sense of oneness with the world.
Did you say the petit mort? You mean the little death?
The little death.
The French for orgasm. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. So actually, yes, there. According to the teaching, that is one of the times, literally, that you can have this clear light experience. The problem is it's very fleeting. So what happens is the energy goes out and it actually hits the bottom of the central channel. You have that very brief like experience. Sometimes people have it more consciously than others, but that is the possibility. And that actually is that is the root of where Tantra has sexual practices, actually. So what you do in those is you instead of letting the energy flow out, you work with that energy and redirect it up, but maintain that petit mort, so to speak, instead of just going, bam, it's done, like that. That's fascinating, yes?
So, you mentioned clear light experience. So, and you correlated that with enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
So, my take on that is an experience, a visual experience of seeing light. So in other words, is that what you mean by enlightened work, where there's an actual interior experience of witnessing a clear light or a radiant light inside the spirit? Is that what your definition is? Because from certain perspectives, especially, say, Hesychism or something in a Christian tradition,
mm-hmm.
like the uncreated light,
right.
And ancient mystics, that's a big, that's a big part of it, is an actual experience of encountering visual lights.
Mm-hmm.
Like Simeon the theologian or somebody like that, Gregory Palamas, I don't know if you're familiar with Christian mystics.
A little bit, I am, yeah. It's fascinating. There was a dissertation I wrote a while back on, it was like, I can't remember the title, something about light and enlightenment and really going through. So, excellent question. From a philosophical point of view, enlightenment doesn't necessarily have to do with actual light. So from a philosophical point of view, it's a kind of merging of awareness with spaciousness that's literally infinite. But from a practice point of view, the texts and my own teachers are very clear that there is a kind of experience that in some ways is correlated with light. Certainly that clear light experience that I was talking about does have that sort of overwhelming radiance. So they talk about the mother and the sun, clear light, meaning the my spirit, for lack of a better term. Buddhism doesn't like the term spirit, but we're going to fudge for now. Merges with like the divine of everything, that it wasn't never really separate
but
to begin with.
Visual.
And there is well, we're talking about death, so visual doesn't exactly correlate, right? But that isn't to say it's not light in a real sense. Right? So it's not, it doesn't make sense. So if a dead person sees light, is it visual?
Yeah, well, not with the senses, but with the interior spirit, yeah.
Then okay, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
Right. If you get an interior spiritual experience of light, yes. Yeah. And there are all kinds of practices that really... Tibetans are very interesting. The Tibetan tradition is very interesting. They've done a phenomenally good job of keeping certain practices secret. I mean, they allude to it, and everybody, if you're really in the tradition, that people will know maybe the names of it, but actually don't tell you very openly. So there are some practices, especially around dark retreat, where you meditate in the dark, that is very much connected to light for
right,
a long
see,
period of time.
Right, see, that's what I'm talking about, the light that shines in darkness.
Yeah.
So in other words, you could be, a mystic could be in a completely dark, black room and have an experience of very bright light.
Yeah, that's true.
I always thought that the highest state in Tibetan Buddhism, particularly, was a visualization of that white light, or that clear light.
Yeah, but that's not a visualization. That's uncreated. So visualization means that you create... So you sit and you're creating something, you have a real experience of that. But what you're talking about is a real experience of you're sitting in a dark room and then there is an experience of light. And yes, that is true.
Yeah,
and
the
then you're talking
closed,
about...
The interior experience.
Yeah, well, in a dark room, eyes closed or open doesn't matter.
Right.
I mean, pure dark, you know. Yeah, that's true.
Okay. So then it has strong correlations with Judaism and ancient Christianity.
Maybe.
Because those are, yeah.
Mystics agree. Mystics tend to agree. Philosophers like to debate. So, from a philosophical perspective, maybe no. But from a mystical perspective, yes. I always am wary of drawing easy conclusions based on similarities because of that. But perhaps there's some smoke there, so maybe there's fire. Yes.
I'm just thinking about the practice of Poa.
Oh, yeah.
The fire and your awareness of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fascinating idea of bringing that down to unite with all that is in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
But then what is the practice where the two come to the heart and mingle? It's like some red and white channel.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what tradition teaches that and what's that called.
Yeah, we're really in the beltway in a lot of ways. So Poa means transference. It's a Tibetan word. P-H-O-W-A. The H is just Po. It's like aspirated H. And it's a practice that you actually do it fairly soon in the path. So it's taught as a kind of insurance policy if you don't attain a kind of stability in this lifetime. And what the practice is you sit, and I'm not going to describe it in detail because you need teachers and all of that to do it, but essentially what it is you focus your mind on an awareness similar to what we were describing, an energetic awareness in the very center of our heart, and then you practice shooting it up outside of the top of your head and merging with an enlightenment visualized by a Buddha, but meaning like your own enlightenment, just up. And the idea here is that at the time of death, the energy within the body collapses. It collapses, collapses. And remember, energy and mind, same. You can't, the horse and the rider, you can't separate out the two. So at the time of death, breathing stops. Some time passes, but eventually the energy collapses into the heart. And then from there, there's an experience where if you have worked on this pathway, you can, in theory, jump your mind out from the top of your head and merge and go to like this pure land. So it's sort of, you don't actually attain full enlightenment like what we were talking about, but it's, you at least can attain a better rebirth And so the idea of how the energy leaves the body is very much a factor in how what happens afterwards in terms of when you die. So that goes to your point. Actually, there are very specific teachings on if the body leaves through a lower orifice at the time of death, if the mind does, then it's maybe not so good. Doesn't mean everything's hopeless. It just means maybe not so good. Yes.
Okay.
But I know the second point of your question. I'll get there. Yes.
So that's an interesting question. So you say, because I know a little bit about the ND tunnel, near-death experience of tunnel.
Yeah.
But I stopped breathing once when I was sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, instead of up like that, I went down a tunnel.
This is a different, so
and
what you're...
I totally freaked out.
Yeah.
I didn't see any light. But I freaked out and I woke up and I just kind of woke up like that and started breathing, gasping for air because I guess I stopped breathing or something. But it was, I propelled myself up.
Yeah.
And I was going, and the thing that freaked me out was that my spirit or whatever was grabbed by something and I was traveling down at extremely rapid speeds, like light.
Well, something grabbing you is maybe not such a good thing, but the other... but the other... So we've talked about... fascinating. We've talked about orgasm. We're talking about death. Sleep. The borderline of crossing into sleep and also waking up out of sleep is another possible experience of this. I've never had this come up sort of like in sequence like this. And if you pay attention when you're going to sleep, probably some of you have had this experience, you have to have a kind of relaxed awareness. And as you fall asleep, you can sometimes feel the moments before you just are falling asleep, there's a kind of feeling as if you're floating in a huge black space or a black room or something like that. Mm-hmm. And if you really pay attention, there can be that little pinpoint of light and you can move very quickly toward it like a tunnel. And the exact opposite happens when you wake up. So when you wake up, the tunnel sort of collapses, and it's exactly how you described it, minus the person dragging you down. But it does have a kind of sinking feeling, and that's how you come up out of it, like you come up. So that's why we actually have, like you guys have heard of Tibetan yogas of sleep and dream. There are specific yogas, practices that you do around maintaining awareness as you fall asleep and then as you dream. So that's where we get all of those are coming from that. So that's the root. And going back to your point, the red and the white, what she's talking about is when I said that your energy kind of collapses, all of your energy goes down into two basic essences. One is the feminine, the red, and the other one down here. And the other one is the masculine, the white, up there. One comes from your mother, one comes from your father, some such. And as they collapse down, one is associated more with aversion, not liking stuff. The other one is associated with liking stuff, attraction or clinging. And they kind of go down, merge. And when they merge, you have that moment of clear light. Why? Because all of the mental conceptions that are blocking you from realizing the way that you really are, infinite, are momentarily removed. Everybody has this, no matter what. If you squash a bug on accident, that same thing is happening. So it's a kind of a biological moment where mentality is removed and there's a kind of clear awareness. Most people can't maintain that. They have, and even in near-death experience literature, they have this, like, I'm going through the tunnel and then I have this experience of clear light and it's infinite and blissful and peaceful, and then all of a sudden, like, I get excited about something and I follow along and then I'm out of it. Or I pass out and then I just wake up in my bed. You know, something like that is oftentimes what pulls people out of a near-death experience. Because we're not used to an awareness that doesn't have specific mental objects. Meaning, we're not used to, when I'm aware of something, there's always a thing that I'm aware of. There's the possibility of having a kind of awareness that's objectless, meaning there's just a pure awareness. And that's what meditation is. That's, if you think meditation is only for stabilizing the mind, you never will make the jump to the objectless, the meditation that is not about breathing, is not about energy, is not about any visualization or anything. It's just about maintaining a pure consciousness. And that's what you need at the time of death to really realize the reality of what we've been all along. Yes.
So do you have either teach or recommend practices that continue on after death?
Any good, what do you do now?
I actually, what I'm doing right now is just reading I Am That over and over again.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Does it have a good result?
Mm.
Then?
Yes.
It will continue.
Yeah, okay.
So you can continue I Am That after death. The reason why, let's say you're doing mantras. Let's say that you don't have so much attainment in this life, or not even mantras, you're doing the I Am That, or you're doing the, what's the one? Forgive me, Jesus, I'm a sinner, or something. Take mercy on me.
Oh, you're talking about
the Jesus prayer.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Mercy on me,
yeah, that's a great one. You breathe out and you just do that all the time. You're doing that all the time. So in Tibetan Buddhism, that's very similar to Om Mani Padme Hum, which is a compassion mantra. Om Mani Padme Hum. Tibetans are just walking around. I'm talking to you. I'm literally saying Om Mani Padme Hum. And I'm trying to connect with the Buddha of infinite compassion, which is actually just a manifestation of my own compassion. I'm trying to get the feeling. So I can kind of do it. I've had enough practice that I can say, Om Mani Padme Hum. I kind of get a nice feeling, more compassion, feel like I'm being held by some love. So I practice my Om Mani Padme Hum, practice Om Mani Padme Hum, practice Om Mani Padme Hum. Bam, I'm hit by a bus. Then I wake up and I'm practicing Om Mani Padme Hum. Now, I don't have a body. I don't have a body. All I have is my mind, essentially. I may feel like I have a body, but I'm dead. If I can practice Om Mani Padme Hum and get that same feeling, right now I get a little bit of it, but if I can do it without the obstruction of a physical body, without these mental things that are holding me back, then I can actually become that thing. I can merge with my Buddha nature. It's just another way to connect. Same thing with in Christianity. People, sometimes people not Christianity, but I think it's really good. You have a lot of faith, you're connecting with Jesus, and then all of a sudden you die, and then you're connecting with Jesus, bam. You've just created a situation where you're merging with the divine. It's sort of like it's like a peak. Have you ever had these peak experiences? We've all had peak experiences, right? Yeah. Are you having one right now?
No.
I had high hopes. Thank you. So you're not having one right now, but the possibility is there for you to have one. So there was a time when I was in Thailand in the sea, and it was raining, and it was absolutely beautiful. Total peak experience. But if you look at it, there were other people there too. They didn't have that same experience. So what was it that caused the experience? Was not the conditions that led to it were not actually the cause. The cause came from within me. So I could, in theory, have the same experience by looking at this napkin, because the peak experience came from within me. Now, how does this relate to spirituality? The spirituality, that oneness, that feeling of the divine is always right there. It's literally right there. But we're just getting in our own way constantly. And the entire point of a spiritual practice is to move those obstacles, namely our self, our concepts and our thoughts, out of the way to then allow that feeling to naturally expand. So
do you think it really doesn't matter necessarily what practice that you're practicing, in a way? It's sort of like I'm trying to find one that I'm going to resonate with more than another, so
mm-hmm.
Is that sort of irrelevant?
Oh, it's very it's relevant because, so practices create effects, right? So you don't just do a practice to do a practice. You want to know why you're doing a certain practice, number one. And then you want to have a connection with a practice that is, in some ways, it's good to do the practices that you don't like. there are practices that people say, I hate the compassion practice, or I hate the breathing practice. And it's like, well, you should sit down and do the breathing and compassion practice and get through that, because
mm-hmm.
actually you're just putting up an obstacle.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other end of things, you should find something that you connect with and resonate with. If you really want to make progress, it's very good to have at least, if not a guru, then somebody that you can talk to that maybe has done the practice for a while, and at least check in. In Sanskrit, they call that a Kalyana Mitra, meaning like a spiritual friend, somebody that can say, oh yeah, you're doing well, try it. try doing it a little bit more like this. That can be very helpful. I have people that I teach that sometimes, I don't know, I don't get sad about it, but I just think they practice for so long and they never connected with a teacher. Maybe they even had a teacher, but they didn't get the teachings, really. They didn't connect with the personally. And it takes them a very long time to have an effect. But if they have a kind of consistent relationship with somebody, mm-hmm. then they can have these experiences very quickly. And then that just reinforces. It's very easy to continue practicing, you know, when you have these positive experiences. I always think mm-hmm. it's like, I meet people sometimes, they've been doing their Zen practice, or not Zen, I shouldn't knock Zen, some sort of meditation practice for decades. And it's like, does it feel good? No. Does it make you calm? No. There's no positive thing that they can necessarily point to. It's like, well, man, can't you reevaluate and do some? There's a whole world of practices. You don't just have to do that one practice. So.
So enlightenment comes in a lot of different forms and a lot of different phases.
No, enlightenment comes in one phase, but the approach is up, completely up to you. It's like getting to a mountaintop. So infinite different techniques going. Mm-hmm. And once you get a little bit higher on the mountain or even to the top, then you can see where everything's going. But if not, then it seems like, oh, they're way over there, they're going the wrong way, I'm going the right way, and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know. But from the mountaintop, they're all reaching up. The problem becomes sometimes people will take one path a little ways and then go another path mm-hmm. and then go another path, and then you end up with nothing. It's like, you know, jazzercise. This, you know about jazzercise?
Uh-huh.
Some exercise thing from a long time ago. It's like if you want to have some, you can tell I work out significantly. If you want to work out and get, you know, buff, you don't do jazzercise. Jazzercise is like for being slim and toned, so I've heard, and all this stuff. So, but if you can't go to the gym and then one day do jazzercise, then the next day do weights, and then just keep flip-flopping, because then you end up with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Pick one and do it, and have a trainer. Better if you have a trainer. If you ever have a trainer, I clearly don't have a trainer, but if I did, I would have be much more buff. So.
You still help.
You are an optimist, sir. I don't know. Any other questions?
Can you bring it back to body and valuing body?
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk, isn't that part of what you were...
Yeah, I guess that's probably a good thing to do. So actually this awareness, our everyday awareness, aside from all the bad crap that we think about, or good crap that we think about, at its fundamental level is divine. It's purely divine. Like that too is the energy that is connected to it. So actually, even without you knowing it, your body is a kind of literal manifestation of the divine that comes directly from your own consciousness and is sort of resonating out in terms of the energy. All the time. In Tibetan, they talk about the mandala of awareness, or they literally say the body is a palace of deities. Not deities like lots of different separate deities. They mean every movement of energy is inherently divine. Every movement of thought is inherently divine. That's why you don't, in real meditation, you don't push out thoughts. You let thoughts go. And then it's like the sky is always clear and divine. Sometimes it's covered with clouds, sometimes it's not covered with clouds. It doesn't affect the sky at all. No stains in the sky. So that's the body. So treat the body well, because it may be we're one thought or second or a heartbeat away from having that experience all the time. That's why it's very hopeful. Not for my exercise, but very hopeful for mm-hmm. spiritual. Yes.
So, to continue that direction towards the body, I really like your, body, energy, mind, energy, body. two directions,
mm-hmm.
and energy being the linkage
mm-hmm.
Between the two. What I like about that is that instead of trying to create a linkage between body and mind without something in between, focusing on the energy creates that porosity
mm-hmm.
between these two things. And I mean, I've been experiencing it the last year because I just started adding a Kriya Yoga practice.
Kriya Yoga is very much in line.
Yeah. And so that's why I was, you know, when I wanted to hear you talk about, and so I'm glad the question came up already, I wanted to hear you come back to the body again because it seems to me that that's what you promised to talk about. It's what you did talk about, and I want to know if there's anything else you have as a little coda here to talk about this connection through energy between body and mind. I mean, you've already it's a pretty simple basic idea, and yet tuning into the energy is so. I have found it to be so productive. So I'm wondering if you have any further comments on that.
I do. I have not so much. I mean, we could go down the philosophical and
mm-hmm.
theory area, and that's fun and interesting. But from a practice perspective, I mean, here's somebody who. How long have you been practicing? For decades. Decades,
over
right?
35 years.
Over 35 years. And now he's doing this Kriya Yoga practice, and I'm not endorsing Kriya Yoga or whatever, but it's a physical practice that has to do with connecting the energy, and right there he's having results that are different, or at least complementary
immediate, strong, and palpable.
Mm-hmm. So it's a way of, especially if you've already developed the mental aspect, then you can go and do this other aspect, and it's such a strong complement. It's like adding water to a seed. Like that also, you'll meet people that are on the other side of it. You'll meet people that are real yogis that, you know, can do these things like generate energy, real strong heat in their body, and then they've never done the kind of more formless mental meditations. But they're the same way. They would be the ones like, talk more about the mental, because to them, that's the water that they need.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have both, actually. You have to have both of those together. You can get all of it in one practice. But it's very helpful to have something that incorporates both sides of that. And the body is, I mean, Descartes in some ways is an interesting guy. You know, that's where we get the Cartesian dualism, the body is not the mind and all that. And in some ways that's true. The body isn't necessarily the mind, but it's very difficult to separate out these three things. So we're talking about them from the perspective of, on a real level, the dividing line between body, energy, and mind is very fuzzy. Very fuzzy. So it's just, think of it more as access points with which we can get to the realization of an original experience, the authentic nature of who we are. Yes.
So Descartes thought the seat of the soul was
the pineal gland.
Pineal gland.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. That's interesting.
Right. So would you agree with that? That's where
yeah, so the pineal gland is that little, you know,
I mean, that's where one would experience, you know, enlightenment, so, well, there or above, and, you know.
Enlightenment, a real authentic experience of enlightenment is not necessarily one in which you can easily point to the experiencer and that which is experienced. So to In a very actual way, it's not, you don't experience enlightenment in a place. You won't say that it's here. So if I say the seat of the soul is there, that's not really doing justice to the unlimited nature of the so-called soul.
Well, when someone's really, you know, there's a radiance that goes through your whole body.
Yeah, right.
That's part of it. So I think that when someone experiences that, that's in conjunction with the experience of light for me. So in other words, it's impossible to experience an experience of light if there hasn't been experience radiated through your whole body.
What if you're dead and you have no body?
Then I would imagine you'd be in a line.
Then, yeah, right, but where would it be? Is it my pineal glands lying on the floor, rotting?
Well, I believe that the light is the soul that's activating the body, and the pineal gland is the seat of the soul, and the light that radiates is the image of God, so to speak, that's the part of us that's divine. Activating the pineal gland, it's controlling the pituitary gland, controlling the entire animated being, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then at death, all that's left is the light, because the essence of the soul is the light.
That last part, yes. Yeah, I wholeheartedly. All that's left is light. If you remove the veils, all that's left is a light.
That's right.
And there's no separation between the experiencer and the experience of the light. In terms of where the seat of the soul is, maybe we can give pineal gland.
I just have one other thing to say about that.
Okay.
The clearest definition that I know of God is consciousness dwelling inside light.
Hmm.
And if that's true, then that's exactly what the human soul is, because our soul is light. And inside that light is consciousness, and that is exactly what makes us in the image of God, is the fact that there's consciousness dwelling in that light.
Yeah, a kind of that in Tibetan Buddhism in particular, they say awareness and clear light are not separated. In fact, it's shunyata, meaning the translation is emptiness, but the Tibetan trope on that is the empty part is that spaciousness or light, and the ness is the consciousness that you were referring to. So from that perspective, there's a similar kind of correlation. And, yeah, I'm being hesitant, but there's some reference to physical centers in the body being seats of something or other. So, yeah.
Well, I agree with you about the energy being the connection between mind and body, but I see the mind and body is also functionally identical. That connection.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole lot of new science developing where the mind is seated throughout the body. In fact, the body will respond before the mind has perceived
mm-hmm.
what it is the body is responding to.
Mm-hmm.
So that the mind maybe, this is a speculation, maybe the autonomic nervous system.
There's interesting. There, I agree. I've read a little bit of that research. So you're talking about the enteric nervous system, and then spread throughout the body. There are, if we were to use a biological lens, neurons that sort of, our biology is much more enlivened by neurons than we had previously imagined,
mm-hmm.
which creates this idea that the mind isn't necessarily here.
But the consciousness is also not just here, but throughout.
Yeah.
It's not localized. This is more of a filtering.
Yeah.
Apparatus and this system and the energy itself. I mean, the energy in the body is connected to the energy all around us.
Mm-hmm.
And that energy, in and of itself, when concentrated, illuminates.
That's absolutely right.
So this blood that you're talking about, you know, could be simply a concentrated form
mm-hmm.
of the energy, because it's expressed everywhere, these kinds of phenomena that you discuss in the body and associated with enlightenment, I could discuss as phenomena of nature.
There, it's not separate from phenomena of nature, because if you talk about enlightenment, or if you're talking about the divine in those kind of terms, by definition it can't be limited. So if you say it's everything but matter, you have a bit of an issue. Right, because you're limiting something that I think, by definition, should be unlimited. But like that too, consciousness. So you were talking about consciousness.
Well, the energy becomes matter. Again, it's a form of the superposition of energy upon itself.
Mm-hmm.
From matter, it can become light. It's a function of energy.
Right. Those are all, but at its base essence, it's energy. But like manifesting as matter.
But what also is speculated about is if that energy has a certain consciousness or can convey information. I mean, these are things that are all kind of being discussed that impacts, I think, the discussion of what is enlightenment and how you achieve it, if this energy itself really has yet to be defined in terms of its capacities and how it affects not only our body, but our body in a field of energy.
From science has yet to be defined.
And the workings back and forth of the interactions of these fields. Because we're not a field in isolation. We're a field within a huge infinity of fields.
That's true. So a field within infinity of fields.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And consciousness as a kind of interplay between energy and so-called matter very much is in line with what we're talking about today.
Well, sometimes I think matter gets a bad rap because, no, seriously, if the matter is infused with energy, the matter is energy. It's not separate from that.
Well, we know Einstein, E equals MC squared. The matter is not infused with energy. The matter is energy itself.
It's a different form. It's simply a different form.
Yeah, that's like saying ice is a different form of water. The essence
right.
is water.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And steam. Actually, that's an interesting... You could talk about the mind as steam, the body as ice, and then energy moving through the body as water. That's a nice little... That could be a thesis for Rob. Question, yes.
In locating the soul, I like going through this one here. And it's something I've shared at many rivers before, that you know that the foot is very small and the earth is very big, and yet in the place where the foot and the earth meet, they meet as equals.
Mm.
So in understanding the soul, I like looking at what I call mystical equality.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's the same thing about the relationship between our word, whose lifespan is only very, very short, and the silence, whose life which goes on forever and ever and ever, and yet in the place where the two meet, they meet as equals. So in understanding the soul, I look to what I call mystical equality. Ethereal and the eternal and material. That's where I locate. That's where I locate the soul.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I just mm-hmm. love equality and the challenge of finding that in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's very beautiful. Mystical equality.
Mystical equality.
I would maybe go so far as to say if there's inequality, it ain't mystical.
Mm. Yeah, please say more.
No. If you think that there's point to a special little thing, you're missing the point. Not you. If one. By what I say, if there's inequality, it ain't mystical. Meaning, if you think this thing is special, everything else is not special. Or my whatever is special, everything else is not. Then you're separating out and collapsing in the thing which is not collapsed.
I just like putting mystical inequality together.
Yeah, that's good.
I think they have the two words have a. I like their relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You people tired?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to go home and rest? You have lives.
I think we should go home and breathe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you for tonight.
Thank you.
I always have fun.
On behalf of many rivers, thank you.
Thank you.